Hello and welcome back. This is Victoria Duda from Zenith Lifestyle, bringing you the new podcast in which we are talking to people who, like many of us, have visited, have taken glimpses of worlds beyond the physical, and who have also found a way to live in both worlds simultaneously, creatively, successfully, and those are our multidimensional people. And today I'm here with author Ross Hochstetter, who has written a wonderful book called The Keepers of the Field, An Invitation to a Unitive Life. Welcome, Ross.
Thank you, Victoria. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, and it's such a pleasure to have you. I might actually tell our audience how I found your book, because it's such a wonderful story of synchronicity itself. I was actually in bed with a broken leg, completely depressed about it, as I love the outdoors and I love a life that is full of adventures. And I wanted to find something to read that takes me away from that prison of my own room. And it takes me on adventure, and I love the adventures that are the spiritual kind, where you go on a hero's journey, as we put it these days, but you come back with a message that is actually telling us something about the inner world, something about the nature of reality. And it is actually a type of book that is really, really hard to find. There are not many books that are really good in this genre. And I came randomly across yours, and it was just a wonderful experience, because it did just that. It took me out of my little misery, and it took me onto a wonderful journey into the wilderness and also into the nature of our own lives and realities. And then I think it was the first time in my life that I felt compelled to write an email to an author that I just found, because it was just such a magic adventure. And then I learned that that adventure was actually quite real, wasn't it, Ross? It was something that you based up on your own experiences in the wilderness in Canada, was it?
That's exactly right, Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you were one of my very first readers, and your email and then our subsequent friendship that's developed has been just a beautiful jewel. It was just so encouraging. You know, when you write these things, you never really know who's going to read them. And writing a spiritual adventure story, or a piece of visionary fiction, as this is called, is its own walk of faith, you know, a walk of risk and trust and transformation for me. And I think any author that undertakes this sort of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what made you write that book? What was that experience?
Well, there was really a compulsion to write the book based upon some experiences that I had as a very young man. And I was at that time a professional wilderness guide in the North Woods of Canada. And the earth that we were walking at that time is the Gaia, the northern wilderness that is a belt that surrounds the world. It's a very rugged landscape carved out by glaciers. It's full of beautiful lakes, clear running streams, water that you can just simply dip your cup into and drink. But it's also a very harsh climate, a very sparse climate, and it's one that requires a great deal of attention to be able to live in successfully. And in many ways, it's a it's the northern journey. You could think of different spiritual paths in the cardinal directions. A guy by the name of Bill Plotkin did that in some of his soul work: north, south, east, and west. The south is usually associated with all of that warmth and right. sensuality. The east is the land of the gurus and the deep, deep state experiences. The west, philosophy. And the mind, and the north is its own cardinal direction, which is a direction of the cold, the clarity, the austere, and also the things that are quite simple and beautiful. And it's a country that strips away everything which is unnecessary, so that you might find the one or something of great value. And that's really what the Northern Journey is all about, and also what the Hero's Journey is all about. Mm. The idea that you would go out, the Hero's Journey begins with the Fool, and the Fool is full of the unbridled optimism and trust that if we allow ourselves to follow our best impulses, sometimes impulses which seem to be coming from beyond ourselves, that we can go through a process where we meet friends and guides and have experiences that grow us up. And almost always it leads us to a form of deconstruction, where the old self is dropped away and a new possibility emerges.
I found it very powerful, symbolic in your book, actually. You were writing also about, it's a lawyer in your book who gets on this adventure, and he carries so much stuff with him at the beginning, doesn't he?
That's right.
He buys all this high-tech equipment because he believes he will need this and he will need that. And at the end of the day, he cannot carry it.
That's correct.
So he gets rid of more and more of the stuff at the end. I think it's just him, and he trusts his environment more and more.
Right.
At the beginning, he needs disinfectant tablets to make the water clean and these kind of
right.
things. And then at the end, he's just drinking like every other animal from nature.
That's right.
And he's fine. This is so powerful because I think we live in a society, don't we, where we all believe we need so much.
That's right.
We become slaves of needing a lot of money, needing a lot of machines and material things. And probably the more we rely on those things, the more we'll forget how to trust actually the universe to give us everything that we need.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question, Victoria, as you're stating so eloquently, that we do live in a hyper world. We live in a world of overstimulation.
Mm.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because that world is, you know, immensely creative. We have immense creative possibilities, and more people are creating more and more things all the time.
Mm.
And I think that one of the dangers of the hyper world is that we become, you know, very distracted and thinking that we are doing something different every day. We're actually repeating the same consumption cycles, watching the same websites, watching the same movies, getting on the same, Facebook loop, where our attention becomes, very distracted and diffused. And so we don't have then the power to concentrate it to really create something, whether that be an artifact or a life or love itself or a state that we could begin to generate as a coherent waveform that has the that actually has the condensed power to work in the world as love, which is something that I want to talk with you about, what love is and how we can begin to put out a coherent waveform. But before we get to that, I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, the hero's journey.
Yes,
and the boon that this character Charlie the protagonist in my book discovered, which was the same the boon or gift that that I discovered when I was out in the wilderness.
Yes.
The notion of the hero's journey is really simply this: is that you begin this process, not really actually knowing where you're going, but it looks like you don't know where you're going. It looks like you're wandering, but actually you're following what might be called a red thread, a thread of something that you can only see when you look back at where you've come and see that along this very crooked road that you've actually walked the straight and narrow. And the way that you can walk the straight and narrow in the hero's quest is the open-hearted path, the path where you are moving into more and more connectivity and more love with your environment, more and more connection with it, losing all of that hyper disconnection that seems like a lot of connection, but it really is very superficial and getting much deeper into it. So this particular character, what happens in this in the northern way is that you begin typically on a journey like this, one begins alone, and that isn't always the case, but usually on a spiritual path, there is a point in time when it's useful to separate from all of the relational elements of the world to begin to, quote, find yourself.
Yes.
And all meditative traditions do that. Mm. Whether you're sitting in an ashram or in a zendo,
yes,
you are essentially in a process where you are removing the interactive world and beginning to proceed by yourself. And that's a little bit oxymoronic because you're never really alone. you're
interconnected.
Yes, you're loneliness. And in your, yes, you're going deeper into a form of interconnectedness, but without all of the relational complexity that we have in our marriages and friendships and families and business life. So it's a time apart from that. So that's really the first element. Second element is that you are in an environment, or one puts oneself in an environment, where our attention needs to become focused. And the beautiful thing about a trip in the wilderness is that that is automatic. If you don't focus your attention, you're going to die.
You die, yes.
And especially when you're alone in the wilderness, if you're not looking at every step, and it's really every step when you're there without any telecommunications equipment, when you're there without anybody else. You're risking your life with every step.
Exactly. And I was thinking that while I was reading your book, that I would be dead already in the wilderness. You remember, because I was reading it with a broken leg.
Right.
So the broken leg only allowed me to survive because I was supported by society.
Right.
But in the wilderness, exactly in that situation, that is it.
Right.
So the focus that I lacked for that 1 minute when I stepped over a root in the forest nearby, that would have been it if it was in a real wilderness.
Right.
So that was a huge eye-opener.
Yes. So attention becomes very important.
It's really important.
And in a meditative or Eastern path in this direction, what is the first thing that meditation does? It forces you to focus your attention on on the breath, on a object, a mantra, where the mind begins to quiet down because it begins to build concentration in what we now know from neuroscience is your frontal cortex, the attention and will creating aspect of your mind, and then other parts of your mind begin to not have a lot of activation, and so this attention is an exceptionally important thing. And I think the third thing that happens is that you do embrace pain on a wilderness trip. Also, in lots of types of meditation, pain is a factor where. It becomes a teacher that you certainly don't want to put yourself in any kind of deliberate pain, but there's a pain of and that happens in a yoga practice as well, that there's a distinction between something that is really stretching you and something that's hurting you, and things that that you might have avoided before because they're painful, things that you need to look at in yourself that you're avoiding because they're painful to look at become quite clear. And so the embrace of what might be called a negative emotion, a pain is really just a resistance, a resistance to what is. And to begin to work through that resistance and embrace that resistance, I think, is a very important third step, and to welcome it. Welcome it as your friend. And welcome it as your friend along the path. And in this particular, place, there was, of course, nature. And this is something that you and I hold very deeply in common. Nature is a fabulous teacher.
Teacher, yes.
And there is a certain vibratory field when one gets deep out into nature. Nature is very coherent. it's had 13.7 billion years to get into balance.
Yes.
And it's much more coherent than the human psyche is at this particular point in time. So it's coherent in an older way, but it is very much alive and very coherent. And it's just fabulous to be in that. There's scientific studies now that show that just walking in 90 minutes of nature calms the nervous system down. One begins to vibrate on a different frequency, on an older frequency, a natural frequency that allows other things to happen. And oftentimes the spiritual journey is likened to a climbing a mountain, like going to a mountaintop. And there is that aspect of the journey that you're striving for something higher. But I think a better metaphor is that it's more like you're descending into the ocean, and that it is one ocean that has many, many shores, billions of shores in the human experience, and that one begins then to strip off the first layer of the ocean, all of the distracting mind, getting into the next layer of the emotion, which is the subtle dimension of reality that you and I have talked about in many times, where subtle dimensions, archetypal forces, ways to begin to experience kind of deeper forces and powers come online, and then that then descends into a quietness, and then there's a final fourth stage, which was the boon of this particular book. That I didn't use this term, but the yogis call it Turiya, which is simply a word that means the fourth. And so that there's these four levels of consciousness. One is the waking state that becomes calmer. One is the subtle state, that which is associated naturally with our dreaming environment, where we have we're open to many, many different forces. And then there's this causal level, this deep, quiet, dreamless sleep. And then below that causal level is this fourth level, what the yogis call Turiya, which I called in this book the field.
Yes.
And I think both are good names for it. But the experience of the field, which is the boon that Charlie has ultimately on his journey, is this sense of completely stepping outside one's previous identity and coming into what is experienced as being inside of God. Elizabeth Gilbert, in her very popular book Eat, Pray, Love, talks about that experience that she had in the ashram in the middle portion of her journey, and suddenly you step outside of yourself, and it's like, hello, you are now the drop that contains the ocean. You see yourself as something unique and beautiful, but intimately interconnected with everything. And the Western mystics call this ecstasis or ecstasy, which literally means to step outside of oneself. And for this moment that all the mystics then fall silent in front of, indescribable, ineffable, can't be contained in words, can only be pointed to, that experience is considered the pearl of great price.
Yes.
the thing that is sitting there all the time, and if we then can strip off these different layers of the ocean, that we can be inside of it and know fundamentally who we are. And that is a great thing to know, to start then the recreation of a life that is in the world and that is in balance and is in harmony. So that's really kind of the story. And the story is how, you know, Charlie ends up getting there and getting all these different layers stripped off, which includes his near-death experience, his reliance on nature, the body being very strong. And it always comes, you know, as a surprise when it happens.
And it is so interesting that you're saying also this indescribable nature of that experience, which is also what people say who have near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. They all say the same thing, that it is not describable in human words. And one of the reasons is precisely because it's no longer part of the hero's journey. It is no longer a story that we can tell that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and can be followed by human logic. It's something beyond that. And I think that's so important, because that's the reason why we also shy away from studying it academically, studying it scientifically, which, in my opinion, is a shame, because we will then always have to rely on religion, and we will not be able to go into a more curious scrutiny, if you want to put it like that. But I think we can probably still describe the way that leads us there.
Yes.
In more objective, more scientific, more academic terms to help people understand it.
Yes.
And then we will have to also probably draw the limits of science, and not just science, but whatever is humanly perceivable and understandable. And just acknowledge that there is something beyond that, which, in my opinion, is really beautiful.
Yes.
It's scary for some people, but I find that fantastic and comforting. There is something that is beyond what we know.
That's something that you and I have in common, and I think that probably most listeners on this show have in common, is that we still believe that there are things that are discoverable.
Absolutely, yes.
Things that are not impossible, like some sort of, you know, I don't know, Godhead or some sort of, you know, and not the basic sort of things like, you know, rote religious instruction and learning the books of the Bible or following revealed truth or something like that. Something that is difficult, but not impossible.
Absolutely.
So, something that actually is quite real, and it isn't created out of one's imagination or not hoping it into existence. We're actually discovering something which is real. It's a real discovery.
Yes, exactly.
And when we're just talking about the scientific method and the usefulness of it, it is so immensely useful.
Yes.
And science right now is our main truth system. And I think if we can see all truth systems, however, as limiting truths, limiting truth, whether it's a revealed truth of some sort of sacred text or religion or science, but it's a limiting truth in the sense that it always sees things from a third-person perspective. It's the I-it perspective. And as we gaze deeply into the it, something interestingly begins to happen. It's the third-person perspective. We gaze deeply into it. Suddenly, the it now becomes a second-person phenomenon. It becomes a we. We realize that the it and I are very intimately connected. You know, we're very intimately connected, and we're in relationship. And then beyond that we state of relationship, that dynamic and polaric balance that happens in relationship, in this mystical experience, it becomes the I. It becomes a first-person experience where there is no separation, not an it, not a we, but an I. And that we become or experience ourselves, like the mystics say, the drop that contains the sea.
Absolutely.
Yes. The whole sea is in the drop. The whole drop is in the sea. it's what you know, the Buddhists would call the non-dual experience.
Yes. And from that perspective, you can see the absurdity of that one drop trying to see the ocean from an objective outside perspective.
Right. Yes, that's right. It is.
We can't do that. And I think it's nice that science itself discovers that. You know, like modern physics is discovering that maybe, yes, the experiment depends on the experimenter.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's giving up that illusion that we are outside of the universe and we can study it like we would study a little artificial ecosystem on my desk.
Yes, exactly right. And oftentimes then they, we talk about then the world appearing as an illusion. And I think that there's a little bit of a danger in that because the physical world, of course, is quite real, but it's really a matter of one's perspective. So when we're in the I, it, perspective, that world is completely real. It's not an illusion. It's a reality that we are able to experience from that particular perspective. The
Yes,
relational
and we are
perspective,
part of it.
yes, it is
We are
real.
part of it, yeah.
Yeah. And so there the are these states of consciousness really allow us to discover worlds that have different layers of reality within them. And I think, as you do, Victoria, that this notion that the world must be seen from some sort of a fixed perspective, and that's the only world that exists, is a big mistake.
Yes.
It's too small for the human being.
Absolutely. Yes. It's a limiting perspective, isn't it?
That's right.
Yes. And it leaves the most interesting thing out of the equation, which is consciousness itself. It's our consciousness that I believe does play a great role in the universe.
Yes.
And
And yes.
yes. Go ahead.
No, and that and the interesting thing about that is that it's, I think, more accurately discovered than created. I think that these what might be called these realms or planes of consciousness are actually real. They're actually things that are pre-existing that can be discovered. They're just
Yes.
we're not just something that we're making up in our heads.
No. It is actually quite a big number. I once went to the trouble of looking it up. There's quite a big number of physicists on the highest level, scientists that got the Nobel Prize, that also sign that consciousness is fundamental in the universe. So you could study the entire universe based on the idea that consciousness plays a fundamental creative part in it. And it is interesting because you said that you want to talk about love, and I just came across a interesting quote from Helen Wambach. She's a psychologist, maybe you heard of her, who did a lot to study the birth experience. She regressed people into remembering how they were actually born, and which is in itself a fascinating topic. They could sense the feelings of the mother and people in the room and all sorts of things like that. But she was the one, and that's why I remember her now, who said that the first thing any client or a patient wants to know who goes to a therapist is whether that therapist loves me. That's how she put that. And I found that such a fascinating thing to actually write down because it's been such a taboo to even say that word. Love was. If you said that as a therapist, you were no longer objective and you violated one of the sacred rules that you have to be objective and not engage in any kind of emotional relationship with the patient. But I think that is changing.
Yes, I think that it is changing.
And people are discovering that love is a force, isn't it? Or a,
Yes, and
what do you think
yes.
about what people say it is?
In this in the in so we're moving into a new topic now. To talking about love, which is, of course, fundamentally interconnected with the previous one, because
Yes.
the previous one is, in my experience, the most complete experience of love in my lifetime. Because the field itself is experienced as love. That's the carrier. That's its carrier frequency. That's how it is. The experience, this feeling of complete interconnectedness with all things,
Yes.
just as they are. And in that experience, I think we love as, quote, God loves, which is, you just love every hair on their head. That is just, you just love them. It's not like it's unconditional, because obviously in a relationship there's all kinds of conditions, and then if we're going to create something together, but that basic experience of simple witnessing of someone and just loving, every hair on their head, it creates then a ground or a field in which new things can happen. And new aspects of the self could be brought forward, which is, of course, what psychotherapy is all about. It's about getting rid of a bunch of old stuff that we don't need, witnessing it, letting it go, and allowing something new to happen. So you asked me what I think love is. So that's what we've just been talking about is an aspect of it. But I think love, as I understand it, at least today, is a complex. It's a complex that moves in a direction towards a target, towards something, which then changes that target and sets up this reciprocal link in which we are being loved in return. And that circle or cycle of love is another definition of the field as it is experienced in the relational space.
It almost sounds like you're saying that is the moving force.
Yes.
Moving energy within the field.
Yes, moving energy within the field. And so the therapist would be a great example that they want to know that they're loved. So what? How do you know that that someone is loved? First of all, there are aspects of it. There are character aspects to be trustworthy, helpful, friendly, caring. You're going to want that. Those character attributes are going to be an internal checkbox that everybody has when they're evaluating a spouse or a business partner or somebody with whom they want to open themselves and trust. In order to be trusted, you must be trustworthy. And so there's aspects of character that it's not just like a language game or a trick. People know when you're trustworthy, and so. Character is part of the love complex. There's also then capacity that is part of the love complex. Somebody, if we're using now this psychotherapist metaphor model, they have capacities. They are trained. And one of the things that they're trained at is that they have the ability to train their attention. And they have the ability to put the attention on things which are unpleasant. Unpleasant people can come into that office and be loved, which is a hard thing for unpleasant people to have out in the other world because they're creating all kinds of fields that are throwing people off all the time for really good reasons. They're not that fun to be around.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot of crap, you know, that people don't want to deal with. So that there's a professional, you know, there's a capacity which takes a will force to love someone, to certainly pay attention. As you know, I was a mediator for many years of my life. I did over 3,000 mediations in my legal context. And that was a decision every single day to be a witness to someone suffering.
Absolutely.
And to be present with them, no matter what they were doing, even when they were biting you.
Like an abused dog.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly right. Yes. To do that. And then there are levels of consciousness that come into that. There's a certain level of consciousness which just says, okay, well, I'm listening to you, but then I'm going to tell you everything about what to do. You know, I already know all the answers, so now I'm just going to let you know.
Yeah.
And then there's another level of consciousness, like the kind of in the postmodern consciousness, that just says, oh, well, everything is okay, and I'm going to listen to you and everything like that, but it really doesn't move anywhere.
Yeah.
And then there's other, you know, different levels of values and consciousness that say, well, hey, look, we're going to get through all this stuff, but we're doing this for something. We're doing this to become, you know, not just free from something or just free to do this sort of circular relational experience all the time, but to become free for something. You're free for something. That's the whole goal of what we're trying to create here. So that has, So love is a complex of different things, and to the extent that the loving person is developed and coherent in their character and their capacity and their values and the level of consciousness that they're bringing to the situation, the chances of getting something really good are greatly expanded. And then I think that for a moment, then the next feature of love is that it does move towards a target which sits at an objective distance. In this metaphor, it's the patient that is going to be changed in a and in that, it's interesting also in this complex that the eye of the loving person, the therapist in this example, drops away, and you become then completely attentive to what's happening. There was a beautiful book on stage fright that was written by a guy by the name of Declan Donlan, and he teaches people how to get out of stage fright. And it turns out that the whole thing about stage fright is this eye business. I don't know my lines. I'm not sure what the character is. I'm not sure that the lighting is right. I don't feel, you know, comfortable. And that's very dangerous territory. To drop all of that away, walk on stage with all of your preparation, knowing your lines and being an actor and everything like that, and to look at Juliet's lips and say, do these lips want to be kissed? And if I want to kiss them, how do I have to change, you know, in order to reach that target? to be open. And then that target is working out there at a discernible distance, and then you can see it changing, and the power of your love and attention begins to change that target, and then the reciprocal thing starts to happen. Juliet opens up to you as Romeo.
It's really wonderful, because if you look at all that, what you're saying is an old paradigm is moving into a new, where we had an old paradigm where love was considered mainly as a feeling. If someone makes me feel good, then I love them.
Right.
And that paradigm moves in a new paradigm. And I talk to many people lately like that. It seems to be, you know, this is coming up. This is something that is becoming global and universal, hopefully, that it is more love is an attitude that is moving towards evolution together.
Yes.
That we share this commitment to evolve to something better and higher. It seems to be that everybody is saying this aspect more and more, that we commit, we have that attitude to move towards something higher and form a kind of coalition for that.
Yes. Isn't that a beautiful idea?
I think it is a beautiful idea.
Yes, and it is actually coming up. You're exactly right that there's a coalition of forces that are becoming free for something.
Yes. So, Ross, let me ask you one more question before we have to come to the end.
All right.
Because when I started this podcast with multidimensional people, I'm very, very interested of one aspect, which I believe so many people must be interested in as well, because there's so many people of us who discover the multidimensional world, non-physical realities, and they discover that there is something more to life than what we can see with our eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think that is because we are evolving, and it's not just a religious thing anymore, but as you said, we are truly discovering that. We are truly discovering a reality behind us all. And as evolution, I feel a little bit we are like, you know, the first fish that starts to come out of the water to turn into reptiles or something like that. And we are in that phase where we have to live in two worlds at the same time. And we have to use sometimes our lungs and sometimes our, you know, go back into the water. So a lot of people say things like, you know, they're still in an old job, for example. That's very old paradigm.
Yes.
Support themselves and their families, but then they have these spiritual interests. And there seem to be a bit of a contradiction or something that is hard to put in a harmonic system.
Yes.
To, you know, experience those higher states, going a spiritual path. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, still live in the world. Find a creative contribution.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Well, you know, what you're talking about is what is now emerging as the new type of occupation. The Atlantic Monthly here in the United States just had an article about the post-work world. Mm. And what's actually happening is that most people in developed countries, all of those sort of baseline jobs, factory work, milking cows, yes. hoeing the garden, stuff like that, are all being replaced by machines.
Yes.
And they're going to be doing that at a much quicker rate, you know, driving, which is is a job for 20% of the male population, if you think of all the delivery drivers and truck drivers and taxi drivers and everything like that. They think that that's going to disappear in the next 20 years.
Yes, they will.
The computerized cars that are going to be much safer. So those sorts of jobs that are concrete operations and that are roles will tend to disappear. But the way that I would like to, for our listeners to think about this is this. I do think that there's oftentimes a split off between the roles that we are given in society and our spiritual longings and aspirations. And so Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is familiar to very many people, I think is a very good model. We do have base needs for security.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that oftentimes will happen when you read books like mine or books that are written is that people give up their entire security structure. They give up their entire security structure, and then they go off to the guru, or they go off on this quest. But that's ultimately not sustainable. People really can't live that way. We must get our basic bodily needs met. And for more and more of us, that's less of a problem. We're not really worried about food and everything so much, but we are very much worried about money, especially if we have children. They need resources. We need to bring them into the world. And so there's oftentimes them trapped in these old ways that are these stable ways of making money that really don't create anything new. They create copies of what's already been created, and sometimes incrementally better copies. But if you're selling real estate, you're still selling real estate, whether it's a two-story old house or a five-story modern house. The thing, is still basically it's a reiteration of these fundamental things. And many jobs, certainly like our jobs as lawyers, really just involve kind of reshuffling the deck.
Yes.
We're really not creating anything new. We're keeping people's assets safe in their wills. We're doing litigation that reshuffles the deck. We're doing contracts and all that. It's just kind of reshuffling of the system. Academia can like that, just reshuffling of the ideas. It to me really doesn't create anything new.
I just remember hearing Raymond Moody, who's doing all the near-death experience research. And he said that very sobering statement, which is so true, that he said all this discussion about, is a near-death experience really the soul leaving the body, or is just a hallucination of the dying brain?
Uh-huh.
And he said it's the same discussion as they had in antique Greece.
Right, yep.
He was originally a philosopher, teaching Plato versus Aristoteles. He said the discussion was the same. We're just moving in circles.
Yeah. So one of the things that's exactly. So one of the things that
we're not doing anything.
Want to tell our listeners is that there's no shame in that. We have to do what is necessary to meet our needs, and if that is necessary for a certain period of time, because you're a mother. Because you're a father, that needs to be done. But our soul, just as you said, wants to begin, especially once we've had some glimpses of these kind of higher states of consciousness that, by the way, really loosen up the psyche and see that there's other things that are possible. The soul then wants to move into a different level where we want to innovate. And we want to create, and the main desire, just like the main desire at some point in time was fornication or survival, getting physical food, getting relational food, all these desires need to be met. But there's a point in time when those desires are adequately met, and the main desire of the psyche or the soul becomes to make a contribution, to have a creative novelty.
Absolutely.
And really what evolution is, which is you just spoke to a few minutes ago, is basically the devotion of one's life energy to an emergent novelty.
Yes.
And so this emergent novelty, and then how then we could begin to support ourselves on the basis of these emergent novelties is our big crisis.
Mm.
That's our big crisis. And that has not been fully worked out.
I think it's also a goal-oriented thinking. So once we build up all those resources,
mm-hmm.
so somebody is, say, in their 30s, in their 40s, they have built up a stable life. They have a house where they can live and they have some form of income and maybe a family. And it's all set.
Right.
Then the question is, what am I going to do these, use these resources for?
Yes, exactly, Victoria.
That's probably where the thinking could be helpful. You know, that it's, of course, we all need the resources, but then why do we have the resources?
Yes, and the studies are now showing that it's certainly here in America, guess how most people use their resources?
Uh-huh.
They sit in front of flat screens and sleep. That's the main way that they send. They look at screens for 50 hours a week, and they sleep the rest of the time. They eat the rest of the time, and that is not enough for a sufficient life.
Yes.
And this is kind of been a sleepiness which comes from having everything that we need, and then just wanting to then have this next form of amusement, the next soccer game, or what you call the football game, the next amusement, or getting into a drug state, or drinking, or something like that, and that creates a life which is not sufficient.
Exactly, but the illusion is that people think if they have enough to eat and a place to stay, and that's comfortable
right.
enough, then they've done it.
Right, and so then
but
there's
that's just the beginning, isn't it?
Yeah, so then there's the pain then. Mm. Of doing what you're attempting to do with this radio show, with your life and with your work, what I'm attempting to do with my book, with my field dynamics teaching, is to bring some sort of a gift out into the world and find a way that the world says yes to it.
Yeah.
And begins then to support in a reciprocal cycle of giving and receiving. And one of the things that I'm dedicated to help people with is that process, because it's an entirely new skill set. And it's a big deal to do it. It doesn't just happen.
Yes, it is a big deal. And it is also something that people have to begin to share.
Yes.
Because you know this truth, I know this truth, and probably a lot of people who are listening to what we are saying right now also know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the first step, but it's still private.
Yes.
And when this becomes shared, when this becomes put together, then we will reach what, you know, they talk about a tipping point.
Yes.
And in order for that to occur, it's about sharing. It's about putting all those little drops of water that we are together into an ocean.
Yes, exactly. Sometimes some people call that the insight economy. Economy where the main thing that is now happening once these other needs have been met is our own personal evolution. Not only then it sounds narcissistic, and I think it is at the beginning, but then it begins to involve your main interest is the evolution of other people.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, making a decision about the direction of this planet as a whole.
Absolutely.
Because we're the keepers of the field.
Absolutely.
That's our role.
And I'm so thankful that you shared all these insights with us. It's been absolutely fascinating listening to you.
Oh, it's been fascinating listening to you, Victoria. I think we've gone a little bit over our time, but
we did,
it's just delightful. It's just delightful to talk to you.
We share what we are here to share. And I really hope to talk to you another time in the future.
Great.
And in the meantime, I wish you well with all your projects. They will be on the website. So please send us your links to share it with the world.
I'll do it.
And I thank you for coming. And I thank everybody for listening. And goodbye for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria.